You know, the Canyon of Heroes has hosted many championships and many celebrities over the years. There are very few people who know what it's like to go down that Canyon of Heroes. They say winning in New York is unlike anything else anywhere in the world. And these two guys next to me, they've both had that experience.
Well, I tell you what, the Met fans, number one, congratulations to the Knickerbockers. What a great season for them. Congratulations. For us, the Canyon of Heroes, it is something that you just can't, I can't describe it to you. It's a narrow canyon, and that's the proper terminology. All the confetti coming down, the outpouring of love from the New Yorkers, and all the way around to City Hall. It's a memory that I cherish so much, but it also, it is the culmination of a long season and a team effort to get to the championship and win. And that's the bottom line. And then to have the affection of the fans, it's just, there's nothing like it.
Yeah, I say congratulations as well to the Knicks. It's, we're just so proud of you. I think of the Canyon of Heroes, what it does, it's a unifier, isn't it? I mean, in a city where you don't look at anyone in the subway, you grab some cement while you're walking on Fifth Avenue, it's the one time that you look around at each other and say, hey, we all did it. And we're so proud of what the Knicks did. And it's just a great, I don't know, I have such gratitude for that moment in my life. And I'm probably not here for 21 years unless that happens.
To that point, you know, you're in a unique position that most people aren't, where you know just how difficult it is to win in general, and especially in this town. What is your perspective, or how do you view watching something like that happen?
It's unbelievable. You watch what they were able to do and how the city rallied around them. You know, it's just pretty crazy. It's what makes New York one of the greatest, if not the greatest city in the world. And in my seat, for us here, we have that opportunity, you know, to do something special. We had a little bit of a taste in 2024 and how the whole city was, especially with the Yankees playing the way they were playing as well. And again, you watch what the Knicks were able to do, man. And my seat, what we're trying to do here day in and day out, is special. Not going to lie. So, yeah, I mean, it's kind of every day you show up with that goal in mind.
It's another edition of the Talking Mets podcast here on this Sunday, June the 14th, 2026. Of course, I'm your host, Mike Silva. You can check me out all the time at thetalkingmetspodcast.com. You get me on X at Talking Mets, no G, and on your favorite podcasting service, Apple, Spotify, pretty much whatever podcasting service you desire. If you want to interact with me, Mike Silva at talkingmetspodcast.com, no G, Mike Silva at TalkingMetsPodcast.com. Come join me at TheTalkingMetsPodcast.com. Chat for free if you sign up. Premium content, updates on the show, all at TheTalkingMetsPodcast.com. And I want to thank the good folks from the Believe Network for supporting this show. Welcome to another edition of the Talking Mets Podcast. And quite honestly, I am tired, as you guys know who follow this show. Huge Knicks fan, was up late celebrating the Knicks' first championship since 1973, a dramatic 94-90 win over the San Antonio Spurs in Game 5 on a Saturday night. And I have to tell you, this entire week, and really since the finals started, I know that I had said on a short over at Extra Innings, you know, and I apologize because I know that I've had so much Knicks intersected with the show over the last couple of weeks. Not a lot, but I know a little bit. It's been really hard, you know, watching the Mets, staying on top of the Mets, but the nights when there's NBA Finals action, trying to watch that, you know, as a fan, stay focused on what the Mets are doing. And ever since the Finals started, the dramatic plays, the late games, the intense competition, especially this week with the two games of the Garden, the incredible Game 4 with the tip-in that I think all of us, regardless if we're a basketball fan or not, will remember as an iconic sports moment, right up there, as I had said when I talked about it on the premium side, with the David Tyree catch, with Bill Buckner, on and on. I'm sure there might be other moments that I'm missing right now, but that moment will go down in New York sports lore forever. And now the Knicks are champions. And I had said to everybody that was a listener to the show over on the premium side that, I mean, some of you have probably experienced championships outside of the Mets. Let's say you were all of my, and I think I'll reiterate it again, in my age group. I was too young to appreciate 1986. I really was. The 80s, late 80s Mets, mid to late 80s Mets introduced me to baseball, but I really cut my teeth in the 90s. That's when I became a teenager. And that's when sports and the mental aspect of what's, understanding sports, I think was at a level that was a little bit more mature. Not quite mature, but maturer at that point. So I couldn't appreciate 86. So I am a huge NBA fan, a Knicks fan. I'm not a big football fan. I just watch, play fantasy football. I have nothing against the sport. But if the Giants or the Jets win a Super Bowl, it doesn't have that feeling. And I'm not a New York Ranger hockey fan. And I was around for 94 with the Knicks run and the Rangers. And I know all the Rangers fans that and what it meant for them when that team won in 1994, which I think is very similar to what we as Knicks fans are going through this today, the day after an event that many of us thought we'd never see, that we were waiting so long for. And the long and the short of it is I just have never experienced a championship from any of my teams. I cover the Mets. I've been covering the Mets now for 20 years independently, a small piece when I say cover. Also fan, but when you do what I do here, I think it changes it a little bit where you have to kind of wear a few hats. With the Knicks, it was just being a fan. I could appreciate the independent content out there with various sites and individuals that do what I do, but it was me just being a fan. I was enjoying the sport as a fan, something that I haven't been able to do with the Mets probably in a forever, because that's not what makes good content here. I mean, what makes good content is me having that fan component, and we certainly, I think, when we had the run in 2024 where Anthony Rivera and I over at Subway to Shea had those post games, I think maybe some of that came out, but you still had to be intellectually honest about the team at that point. So the feeling I have, and I think there might be some of you in the audience, I mean, some of you that may not be football fans or hockey fans or even Knicks fans, that yet, because you love the Mets, have not yet experienced what I experienced last night, seeing the final 2 minutes, the final 90 seconds, the final minute, the buzzer sounding, the feeling of it's over and the excitement of your team accomplishing what only one team can accomplish. And if you live to be 100 in this world, which is a grand old age, you're only going to see 100 of these, right? So if your team wins one or two of them, you're only going to go at the end of the year home happy 2% of the time, right? It's a great feeling. But I also think that there was a few things I took away as I was watching, and I'll put aside the goons that ruined it and what, the things they did in the city with burning buses and climbing poles and beating up Spurs fans or just beating people up. Like, that's a whole nother discussion of society. That's not what I'm talking about. I'm talking about the fans that celebrated in the West Village, the fans that celebrated in Huntington, New York, the fans that celebrated in Williamsburg, Brooklyn, the fans that celebrated up in Westchester or in New Jersey or wherever you are that you root for this team. Those fans, what they're feeling. And I think the thing that I always have told you guys that you're never going to see and you're never going to experience as Mets fans in this city is you're never going to experience what I experienced as a Knicks fan last night, even if you win a championship. And why do I say that? Because the unity that this city had around this team, and I understand that the Brooklyn Nets are a thing for some people. Our good buddy Steve Keen came on a couple of weeks ago and talked about, even though he grew up watching the Celtics, he's lives in Staten Island now, he's a Brooklyn Nets fan. There's a whole subset of fans that, because they didn't like the Garden or the Knicks were your father's team and the Knicks represented the old establishment, that they decided to go with the Nets, with Durant and Kyrie Irving, but I think that's such a small percentage. What you saw, how this city united together outside of the goons that ruined it a little bit, and they're a small minority. You don't see that in this city, because I've been jealous of Boston. When the Red Sox win, the state, you know, New England celebrates. When the Patriots win, New England celebrates. When the Celtics win, New England celebrates. When the Bruins win, New England celebrates. And it's a cool, like, that's what I always was jealous in 2004 when I watched the Red Sox. I'm like, that's really cool, like, that camaraderie. And I didn't think the Knicks would bring it together because it's not baseball, and maybe it's a sport that's more, I don't want to say niche, but, you know, has an acquired taste for some people. And that could not have been further from the truth. What I experienced as a fan, what I saw when I went to the deli this morning, to quote Jose Alvarado, to get my bacon, egg, and cheese sandwich without the Arizona. And if you're a Knicks fan, you'll get that. I got my bacon, egg, and cheese sandwich, my blueberry muffin. Mine came on a poppy seed bagel, my bacon, egg, and cheese. I got my coffee and, you know, just Knicks fans around wearing their gear, going to Dick's Sporting Goods and seeing, I mean, a line here in a small town on Long Island, Lake Grove, seeing a line of people buying Knicks merch wiped out. Seeing the celebrations, the feel good. I mean, my wife, who's not exactly a huge sports fan, getting enthralled with this team and watching all these games, and, you know, really her and I having such good fun together watching all this. You know, calling or texting my brother, thinking about my dad who watched all those games with me when I was a kid in the 90s and taught me about basketball and the 70s Knicks, and thinking about the frustration and heartache and challenges that we saw as fans in the 90s with those Ewing, Riley, Van Gundy, Starks, Houston Knicks. I mean, we're never going to experience that as Mets fans. I mean, I think you'll have a large contingent of the city get excited. I don't know if we'll ever experience that. But that's okay, because there's going to be enough of a party when this happens. And I think the Mets now that the Knicks have kind of wiped the curse, and I don't really consider the Rangers, even though it's been a while since they broke their curse, and it's not 50 years yet, but maybe another 20 years we'll be talking about them again, right? I don't think that they fall into that category. The Jets, for sure. Is it the Jets or the Mets that are the next team that kind of has that New York yoke? We'll see. But that was the first thing that I think, connecting to baseball, that I thought about. The second thing is something that Josh Hart said, and I've been saying a lot. And if you listen to his post game, it was thrown in there. He talked about the weight of the jersey, and I said, "Wow, that's interesting." Because I talk about that a lot here, in context of the Mets and the yoke, and maybe how I felt that when Lindor hit that ball over the wall against Atlanta a couple of years ago, maybe the yoke was broken a little bit, because it seems like that, no matter what, the weight or the prior failures, especially the failures of the last two decades, have always followed the future teams, even though the players who are on those teams had nothing to do with any of those failures. And some of them weren't even, you know, weren't around in for all the failures that go on. They're too young to be even, you know, they weren't around for 1999 or Timo Perez in 2000 or something like that. So I thought about that, and I think that is something that's a thing. You know, there's a player who might have gone down as an all-time GOAT just a couple of days earlier, talking about the weight of the jersey. And I said, you know, it is true. I'm not crazy. I do know what I'm talking about. And I think that the Mets have a little bit of that. And I think they have to figure out how they manage that weight of their jersey and what special group of Mets can do with this special group of Knicks players. And you want to talk about the Spurs mistakes, and they had an easy path. I'm already hearing the backhanded compliments. Look, I don't care what your path is, who you played. I mean, I could argue that you know, the Lakers playing the Nets in the early 2000s, that wasn't exactly the hardest Eastern Conference opponent either, okay? So, you know, we could go in history, and you know, we could talk about the Spurs playing a couple of weak Eastern Conference teams and what have you. But at the end of the day, there is a thing about the weight of a city, of a team, of ghosts And what I saw with this Knicks squad is, I mean, I've never seen former players, fans, celebrities all band together and try to push this team over the finish line. It's incredible. I mean, have you seen when the Mets go on a postseason run? I mean, yeah, you know, you got some guys like Darling Hernandez who are around the team. You know, a guy like a Piazza or a former player will come out and throw the first pitch. Strawberry Doc will chime in. But you don't see, and maybe because it's a different sport, you don't see a group of former Mets just sitting in the stands trying to push the Mets over the finish line. You just don't. It was an incredible thing. It was almost like it truly was a unifying run where we could all put our differences aside. I didn't see any toxic behavior from the fans, even with the stress and the pressure. And on the back of the head, look, I'm a fan too. All I kept thinking is, you know, if they lose this game, game five, and they go back to the Garden, there's so much pressure on that game because 3-1 lead could become 3-3 in game seven on the road against a tough opponent in a flash. And I thought that was really cool. And I think it's something that, you know, Steve Cohen was at that iconic game four. I mean, some of you probably saw the video with him on he was next to Ben Stiller and some of the celebrities right by the Spurs bench. And I got to think that Cohen's looking around the Garden, looking at these star-studded fans and this intense environment and this pure joy and saying, this is what I got to figure out a way to bring to Citi Field. This is what I got to figure out. And I guess that would be my final point as I connect a little Knicks and Mets here to open up the show before we get to baseball business. What I saw, and I understand it's a completely different dynamic, and all I could speak for, I'm not, you know, covering basketball and in the weeds like a Knicks Film School or CP the Franchise or any of those great, the guys over at SiriusXM, Termini, Isola, Scalabrini. I mean, I could go on and on. There's so much good content in the NBA. I don't see every team, but how the Knicks are able to use some modern thought, film, analytics, coaching, and collaboration with the players and the coaching staff and the front office. Essentially why Thibodeau was fired was because it was my way or the highway, which is a very old school, a way that I've supported when, you know, hey, you bring in a Thibodeau or who grew up in the under the Riley tree there, Van Gundy, Riley, that kind of thing. You're going to get a little bit of my way or the highway, but the way that, especially now where you have front offices that are wrestling control and doing their way or the highway or, you know, one size fits all type of mindset in baseball, you didn't see that with the Knicks. You didn't see that with how not only did they pivot at times throughout the season, they pivoted within the postseason. I mean, it wasn't like the front office says, look, this is what the analytics say. I know we're down 2-1 to the Hawks. I know things didn't look good for a couple of days. You know, the process, you know, yeah, the process, but it was also about, are we putting ourselves in the best chance to win with this group and how can we meld this group of players and put a system and a game plan in place that is successful with these players? And you really don't see that in baseball anymore. You know, we've been talking about it so much about organizations like the Mets forcing hitters to be one way and, you know, going out there and not pivoting or adjusting when all the facts are against you. And David Stearns falls in that category. And I know that's probably one of the big things that is a criticism of Stearns. And I still have a lot of faith in Stearns. But I think what you could learn from that is, wouldn't it be cool if we got back to a situation where the manager has a little bit more say in who plays and how the lineup goes? And you know, we don't really know how much say a Carlos Mendoza has. But you got to think, when I know one of the criticisms I've seen over in the chat room this weekend was about punting the Saturday afternoon game by resting some starters and putting some 4A guys in there. And, you know, was that Carlos Mendoza? Was that the front office? We don't know. But we probably guess it's a directive that did come from the front office. And it would be cool if you, and it's so different because making a change in game four of an NBA playoff series versus mid-June in baseball is night and day. It could not be any different. And if anything, after coming down from the Knicks high and watching some Mets Braves over on SNY, and you know, a baseball game in June, no matter how important it is or how intense the rivalry is, it's never going to meet the intensity of the NBA Finals. You see the stark contrast. That's for October. But, you know, it was refreshing to see, I guess, rooting for a team in a sport where I still think analytics has driven the train there in the NBA too. But I still feel like, at least with the Knicks, there was some component of the human eye and collaboration between the field, which is the head coach and the coaching staff that are on the court, and the front office, that you know, it'd be nice for you to see a little bit more if you know, in baseball. So those were some thoughts, connections with the Mets. I'm on a high. I feel great. This is an awesome feeling. And when the Mets win, and they will, and I'll be there doing this when they will, I'm pretty sure of it, God willing, knocking on a lot of wood, we're still going to have a big party. We're still going to have a great celebration. And all I'm going to say is I don't think the city will band together. I don't think Yankee fans are going to be looking to push the Mets over the hump whenever they get to that point. And it could be, well, look, what are the Mets, 86 Mets on 40 years now. So if they're anywhere near like the Knicks, we got another 13 years of to wait. And hopefully it's not another 13 years, right? I don't think they'll be doing that, but I think there'll be a good chunk of the city that will get behind the Mets, get behind them, or whatever that group is, pushing it over the top. And I'll leave you with this before we take a break and we get to some baseball. The best part about winning a championship, for me, and I think this will be the case when the Mets win, is that the stuff that's happened over the course of your fandom that stuck to you, the regret, the hurt, the what if this just happened. And in basketball, it would be the Charles Smith blocks at the end of game five against the Bulls, or 7 points in 7 seconds by Reggie Miller, or 2-for-18 Starks, or the suspensions from the Miami series, or Van Gundy quitting in the middle of the season, the Carmelo missteps, the Isaiah Thomas era, Halliburton shot from a couple of years ago, and I could go on and on and on here, you know. All that stuff that stuck to you, the what-ifs, the missteps, LeBron not coming to the Knicks. It doesn't matter now. You got a championship. Yeah, maybe one day you'll look back, say, you know, this. You could always, but those things don't stick to the ribs because now you've climbed the mountain. Now for the Knicks, the challenge is, can they stay hungry? What does the next 2-3 years in a very short window sport look like? But that's not for this show, and that's a conversation for another day. All right, let's take a quick break. When we come back, the Mets are playing better. They took a series from the Braves. The NL wild card is the muck of all mucks. Here at the Talking Mets podcast, we kind of wave the white flag to a certain degree and prepared for a possible sell-off. David Stearns is not ready for that. And it looks like they're going to try to push forward. And quietly, thanks to a national league that's a bit of a parody league, mediocre if you want to call it, and the Mets hanging in there, the Mets, outside of their 12-game losing streak in April, haven't been all that bad. So let's take a quick break. And when we come back, let's piggyback on a piece written by a contributor here over at the Talking Mets Substack and look and see if there's a pathway to summer relevancy, maybe not in the form of what the Knicks did, but summer relevancy for a playoff spot. And what do the Mets need? Because we're in that what do they need phase now that we kind of know what this team's all about to get it done. You are listening to the Talking Mets podcast. We'll be back with more right after this. All right, we're back. So let's take a bit of a positive vibe. Let's take some cues from our friend David Mills, special contributor over at the Talking Mets podcast, Substack. And he wrote a piece Saturday night after the Mets game that I published, free for everybody, kind of taking a glass half full perspective on this team that right now, after taking 2 out of 3 from Atlanta, is only, what, 4 games out of a wild card? Now, that's a bit deceptive. I should say, sorry, not 4 games. 5.5 games out of a wild card spot. 4, really. Well, no, 6 in the loss column. But, okay. So, you know, I was looking at the Reds for a minute. Not impossible. Not impossible to make up that ground. But there's 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6 teams in front of them. And they're closer to San Francisco, who's behind them, than they are to San Diego, who's in front of them with the final wild card spot. And there's a bunch of teams in between, including division rivals like Washington and Miami, that are playing a lot better. The Mets NL East is getting a lot better. Long gone are the days where they could fatten up on Miami and D.C. and you know, just say, okay, you know, we'll just have to fatten up on them and then manage the NL Central and the West. No, you know, you got teams in all three divisions that are a problem. So David took a glass half full perspective, and I was reading it and looking at some of the comments you guys made, and I said, okay, let's play along, because at this point you really have nothing to lose. I mean, Stearns is already, I mean, rumors are they're not looking to sell right now. If they do sell, it'll be closer to the deadline or exactly the deadline. How those sell-offs look like, I still think that, and I go back to what I said about Cohen being at the Knicks game the other day, I have a hard time, even with the lockout and maybe some baseball Armageddon coming because of labor strife, I don't think Cohen's going to take a step back, payroll or not. I mean, the new rules, we'll see how it comes into play with roster building, if they put some kind of cap or restrictions on transactions. But right now, you have to look at the Mets and say, okay, this is a team, and let's just go and look at some splits right here. This is a team that, outside of the, you know, Pythagorean win-loss is 33-37. They're 12 runs under, I think, 11 or 12 runs under, minus 11 in run differentiation. And if you look at their record in May, they were 16-12. And in June, they're about 500. So they've been playing 500. But they've been playing about, you know, they've won, let's see, 22-18. So they're you know, 22-18. So they're playing about 550 baseball, which is pretty much what you're seeing the Cardinals play at the top of the heap of the wild card. Now, the Cardinals don't have a 12-game losing streak on their resume that put them all the way down like the Mets. But it's a long season. There's a lot of teams in this muck, and a lot could happen. And the only thing you can control is what you control. So if the Mets are going to play 550 baseball the rest of the way, and let's just do some quick math here. 32-39, so they played 71 games. So there's 91 games left. And 550 baseball puts them at another 50 wins. So they're going to be on pace right now, if they stay at the current rate they've been playing at since May 1st, to win about 82 games. I do not think that gets them in the playoffs. Now, can they go on a run and scoot that into mid-80s, 85, 86, or do something like they did during the OMG summer a couple of years ago? It's going to take a couple of winning streaks. It's going to take, like that team did, and play a big, what would they play, 660 baseball in September. It's going to take something like that. I don't know if this team has it in them. But let's take a look at the roster. So right now you have Lindor coming back. Looks like Bichette's coming into his own. And the lineup with Jared Young at first base. Like the lineup now, if you look at this lineup, with the kids like Ewing and Bench inserting the defense, the speed, the energy. And you have Alvarez back. Still think Alvarez is a hitter. It's going to be painful to watch him day in and day out. I think Torrens' glove, if he could only hit a little bit more, I mean, he probably would yank the job away from Alvarez. You put Jared Young, who's playing really well at first base. Simeon hasn't had a great overall year, but seems to be hitting with runners in scoring position, and the bat's perking up. Bichette at third, Lindor at short, Soto in left, Ewing in center, Benjamin right. And then you figure out your DH spot. Maybe Soto plays the DH spot. And, you know, I'm assuming Polanco right now is not an option, but eventually Polanco comes back, professional hitter at the DH spot. Mets are averaging over the last 16 games almost 5 runs a game. I think there's enough offense there. I really do. To be competitive. As David pointed out, I know everybody likes to make fun of run prevention and what Stearns talked about over at the end of the year press conference, the Mets are actually, depending on where you look, and I'm not big on defensive runs, DRS, you know, numbers, because I really think defense is something that you have to evaluate with the eyes. And, you know, the Mets defense has been pretty good. They're top five in the league in defensive runs saved. Now, when you look at the pitching, sure, the pitching and the starter side doesn't really rank well in WAR because of the opener and some of what's going on there. You've had some rough start, you know, rough outings there by Peterson and Manaea and things like that. But overall, they're top 10 in FIP. The Mets bullpen is top three in least amount of walks allowed. They're actually top within the top 10 as a bullpen. The bullpen has actually been a strength. You look at you know, guys like Rosenbaum, who has been an opener largely, great numbers. Luke Weaver has been nails coming out and setting up for Devin Williams. Raley has been all-worldly for the, you know, since he came back from Tommy John surgery. Austin Warren has been a great addition coming up for the minors. A.J. Minter talked about this over at the New York Post. Maybe he doesn't throw as hard as he used to, but he's becoming crafty and learning how to pitch. And even Daniel Duarte and Cionel Perez, trash or treasures, there are not bad, you know, coming out and doing their thing. And they've all – Duarte is someone that the Mets have liked all offseason. We talked about that over at the Substack over the offseason when we profiled him. And Cionel Perez actually has had some decent numbers in the past in other stops. So the Mets bullpen – and I know Williams I'm glazing over, but I still think Williams is a guy that – you know, outside of a Mason Miller or an elite closer of that ilk, Diaz, when he was on, he's like every other closer. And he's probably better because he's got good stuff. And statistically, he's been a top five closer in the sport since he became a reliever in Milwaukee. So, you know, that's just something that, you know, to look at. So you look at that. So there's a lot to work with there when it comes to, you know, this team doing some kind of run for the postseason. Now, what we like to do at this phase, we start to talk about here in mid-June, because we're about 6 or 7 weeks away from the trade deadline, and that's when the meat and potatoes, where the Mets are going to have to be first to be taken seriously for any kind of playoff spot, even in this muck of a wild card. You got to get to 500. And right now, with the way they're playing, it's going to take a couple more weeks. They're probably not going to be able to get to 500 till sometime around the 4th of July. So they continue to play well. Somewhere around the 4th of July, you'll see them get to 500. And then at that point, you could be taken a lot more seriously in your playoff pursuits. Might take a little bit of a run. You know, they got some games on the road with the Braves and the Phillies and things like that. So, you know, there's a lot of work to do here. But if you look at the roster and you start to say, okay, assuming that, let's assume Polanco comes back and can hit out of the DH spot, that kind of settles your bat. You got that bat, because that's the bat you're missing. Lindor is going to come back, and unless he's compromised, he's going to be Lindor. And that's a huge addition. Ewing and Benj have already shored up the outfield, so you're not really worried about a Luis Robert or bringing another bat for the outfield. What I think the Mets could do, and this is the big if, over the next 4, 5, 6 weeks, they have to see if Jared Young is for real. Because if Jared Young is for real, and, you know, right now he's got an 830 OPS coming into today's action, and he contributed to the win today. If Jared Young's for real, then all you really have to do at that point is take a look and say, hey, can I go out and get myself some kind of right-handed bat that could complement Young at first base? You know, who that person is, I think those are some ideas that we have to start thinking about throwing out there. You know, you could go on this, you know, now and spitball. You know, I'm talking conceptually. So if you look at, you know, right-handed hitters that play first base right now, you know, it's not like all of a sudden, you know, these guys grow on trees, you know? So right-handed positional split as a first baseman, you know, you start looking at this. You know, Wilson Contreras in Boston comes to mind, but he's more of an everyday player. Christian Walker, Houston, I don't know if they're going to sell off, you know, perhaps, but, you know, that's a guy. I know what all you're saying, well, they had Pete Alonso. You know, that's not an option. They kind of need what the Yankees have in Paul Goldschmidt, believe it or not. Paul Goldschmidt would be a perfect option against left-handed pitching. So I think that's something that the Mets need to take a look at over here. And you know, that would be one thing that they that I think that would beef up the offense. Now, assuming Polanco comes back, then that's the thing. Now, if you could get a Contreras and put him at the DH, Polanco doesn't come back, or put Young at the DH. And unfortunately, the thought would be that Vientos could be that guy against left-handed pitching. I just don't know if Vientos has it. You know, Vientos, Alvarez, Beatty, we've talked about them so much. I don't want to talk about them again. I just don't think these guys have it. I really don't in any way, shape, or form. So that's number one. Number two, and I think David points this out in his piece over at, and you could go to the Substack, you could access it through the TalkingMetsPodcast.com website. The lack of length out of the starters is becoming a problem again. I mean, this is really what did them in last year. And they're lucky that guys like Brazenban and Warren and for a while Tobias Myers, I think he's going to be getting a start in Cincinnati this week, were able to, and in Manaea, give them these multi-inning outings, win or lose, that save the bullpen and has reduced some of the shuttling. That's part of it. But I really think that acquiring, and you know, I don't know who's out there right now. I'm going to throw you some names in a minute. Acquiring, I'm not saying going in and getting a Tarik Skubal. And with Miami in the race, and he's not even pitching that well, I mean, ultimately, a lot of, myself included, a lot of fans thought maybe Sandy Alcantara would be available at some point. I don't think that's, the, you know, he's going to cost you a little bit of an arm and leg. I'm talking about a reasonable. I'm talking about somebody who they thought, like, when they got Paul Blackburn a couple of years ago, that was the kind of pitcher I think they thought that would give them some innings, quality innings. And it turned out it didn't work. Got hurt, it didn't work, and it blew up. But if you start to look at the pitchers right now, and let's just focus on pitchers that provide innings and teams that potentially. So I'm just going, I'm not even looking at production right now. I'm just ranking top innings pitchers and pitchers on teams that potentially would be available. And nobody that has high upside. So like a Joe Ryan, no, like nobody like that. I wonder if somebody like a Michael Wacha would be an option. I know the Mets have gone there before. Seth Lugo, maybe. I'm not sure if he's available. You know, I don't know the terms of his contract. But you look, those are two names off the bat that give some innings that could come into this rotation. And I'm not saying they'd be aces, but just going to give you six or seven innings, quality innings, as a traditional starter, so that you don't have to dip into the bullpen those days. I mean, nobody does complete games anymore. I'm not even going to look at that. So those are some, I mean, maybe, and I don't know, you know, LA's got Jose Soriano who's having a great year. Is there a way to use some of your prospect capital to get a pitcher at the deadline that could help you next year that you feel is established, that you could work with, that is ready to bust out? We talked about this in the offseason. Who is a bust out candidate? We talked that Joe Ryan was one of those names that's going to be the next thing that the Mets can acquire and then take them to the next level. George Kirby was a name. I'm not even talking about those kind of guys. I'm just talking about guys that are on losing teams that might be available for a reasonable prospect haul. Because I think that's the other thing. You know, when they're depending on where they are in the muck at the deadline, do you even want to get involved in any of this stuff and give up prospect capital for any kind of, you know, whether it's a rental, even somebody? I think, and we'll dive deeper into this and look at contracts as we get deeper into the summer. This is our first interaction to that. You probably want some controllability with anybody that you acquire. You know, that would be the thing. And then, of course, there's always that, as good as the bullpen has been, can you go out and get yourself another bullpen arm? You know, do you want to do what you did there, you know, last year by bringing in a second closer? I don't know if that's, you know, they had some, you know, they brought in Soto and what have you, and so on and so forth. I don't know if they want to do that again. It cost them some prospect capital. I don't think it's going to, you know, come back to haunt them. I mean, if you look at Baltimore right now, because there's, you know, you look at the Orioles and you look at Helsley. I mean, he's done okay. His walks are high. He's done okay. He's on the injured list, but he's done okay. And, you know, do you want to go that route and bring in a closer, a second closer like that route? Someone to help out Devin Williams a little bit. You know, we'll see. To the Dodgers, I know that no one's talking about his peccadilloes with the cockfighting. Do the Dodgers want to trade Diaz if and when he gets healthy? So We have to see. Do the Orioles want to trade Rico Garcia? Could use him, right? I'm poking the bear with the Mets fans there. So, you know, that's kind of where you're at now. There is reason for optimism. I think that you can't really get excited yet because you're not at 500. But they're playing better. They're playing 550-ish baseball. I know they're 500 this month. You look at the schedule, and really, the beauty of the schedule in this race is that it's not like this is mid-July and they're teasing you, you know, with being under 500 by five or six games, and you're going to have to say to yourself, you know, can they really, with, you know, 8 or 10 weeks left in the season, is this really worth investing in this team? You have some time between now and the deadline to really get a good evaluation of this team. And with Lindor coming back, maybe Polanco coming back, or maybe Polanco not coming back, and or even coming back and showing that he can't, even as a DH, sustain health, that will answer your question. Because then you're going to need a much bigger bat than just someone to get lefties. Because I think the lineup will be pretty good and just needs some kind of touch-up on the lefty side on that. So we're going to be diving deeper into these concepts as the month goes on. I think this is the first time we've really felt that we could seriously have a conversation. I think David sparked it a little bit with me with his piece over at the Substack. He always, you know, David's always good at giving us ideas, challenging us, not just with the prospects, but our thought process, you know, due to the fact that he looks at the game a little bit from a development perspective and from a scouting perspective. He has a different eye than I do. I sometimes look at things a little more in a radio aspect, you know, I don't want to say a fantasy baseball aspect, but maybe more of a front office analytical type of sense, so to speak. So, but, you know, they got the Reds this week. They got the Phillies. They got a day off on Friday because the World Cup at Citizens Bank. That's a weird thing. A Friday night in the summer without baseball. And that would have been game 7 of the NBA Finals. You don't even have to worry about that now. You truly could enjoy yourself this coming Friday. Got to check out the weather. Enjoy yourself and get away from sports. Then they have a homestand against the Cubs and the Phillies. And then you go into Toronto and I believe Atlanta. So it's going to be the next 2 weeks are critically important. The Mets have to play well. They have to play well in Cincinnati. They're ahead of them. They have to play well against the Phillies. They have to play well. I mean, these are going to be games that are going to really determine, you know, this club. And look, the one thing maybe we didn't really dive into a lot, we talked about how the staff is, you know, needs some help because it's not going long. And if you look at their FIP, they're in the top 10. But, you know, Fangraphs has them like number 17 in WAR, and I think it's because of the lack of length. A lot is going to be thrown on the shoulders here of McClain and Scott because, you know, they're going to have to be good. I know McClain has not been great. He's been inconsistent. He's still walking a lot of batters, not going deep. You know, had a really laborious inning against the Braves on Friday on the Apple TV game. You're still a long ways away from getting Clay Holmes. He's almost like a deadline acquisition if he indeed is going to come back in August. So you got Peralta, McClain, Scott, not a bad three. You've got Peterson and now, you got Manaea getting traditional starts. Now Tobias Myers, and I don't know how they're going to spread things out with the opener and what have you. It's a rotation that probably could use an innings guy. Really an ace. I mean, you put Scooble in this rotation, everybody goes down the pecking order. You thought that's what you were getting with Peralta. Peralta's not an ace. Peralta is a 5 to 6 inning guy that could give you, like he gave you today, a really good 5 innings. But you're going to have to get 9 to 12 outs out of the bullpen. That is not an ace. And he's looking for a 7 or 8 year deal. I told you guys in the winter when he was acquired, I liked the trade. I don't think the Mets are going to regret the players they gave up. I think if they trade him at the deadline, they could probably get back some prospect capital that might even be better than what they gave up. I don't care about the rankings and stuff, kind of what Jet Williams and Sprout are going to be versus what they could get, depending on how desperate a team is to beef up their rotation. But he is not an ace, and he's not someone that should get a 7 or 8 year deal. He's a 4 year deal guy. He better wake up. He's a 4 year, $120 million guy, if you really want my honest opinion. So, another conversation for another day. All right, let's take a quick break. When we come back, mailbag, get to your comments, questions. I have something from John Vanderwall that I tweet that I want to talk about, and more right after this. All right, we're back. So some mailbag, getting to a little mailbag. I got a tweet from John Vanderwall. So as you know, with the mailbag, the way it's evolving is your comments on Twitter, your comments on Spotify or Apple, or your comments on my email, Mike Silat, TalkingMetsPodcast.com, no G. I try to get everybody in there, and I try to have a decent conversation. I try to keep it with the flow of an hour show. Even though we don't have a clock over our heads here, and believe me, a couple of weeks ago, I think we did almost a two-hour show. I try to keep this thing to an hour because I think that's what you guys want, and that's what the patience level for a show really is in this day and age. And it's probably longer than what a lot of other shows do. But anyway, let's start out. Let's go to the mailbag. Some of old friends. Jason writes, the Mets could lose 100 games this year and it would be okay because of what the Knicks did for the city. And it shows curses aren't real and anyone can win the title if you do smart team building. I'll be fascinated to see how this team finishes the season and how they improve it in the offseason to finally become a champion like the Knicks. So that's interesting. So I talked about, maybe it's not curses, Jason. I talked about it in the open. Think about what Josh Hart said about the weight of the uniform and a group of players who come in and feel that weight and pushing through it. I mean, there was plenty of opportunities for this team, particularly in January when they lost 9 of 11 to go sideways. They could have went sideways in round one against Atlanta. And let's face it, against San Antonio after they lost game three and were getting blown out of the building in game four. I mean, they could have just said, all right, you know, that's it. These guys have finally broke through. They're better than us. Nice year, but they kept pushing and pushing. And I think what you see out of Brunson is a special player. Now, baseball's not like the NBA. One player can't come in and make this significant culture change. But I think the Mets need that kind of guy. And I'm not sure, and this isn't a knock on Soto and Lindor, I'm not sure they're the guys in that way that can do it. It has to be maybe one of these young guys. Maybe it's somebody else that could come in and kind of, and baseball's not the same, but you need someone kind of like a Hernandez or a Carter or a veteran to come in and bring it all together. And it'll be interesting if they could find that guy, and I don't know if that guy exists. But what's interesting is that because of what the Knicks have done, it maybe has toned down the crossover fans, Knicks fans and Mets fans. It's toned down some of their frustration on the season. Might give the Mets a chance to breathe. And let's be honest, the Mets have had an incredibly easy time of hiding since the 12-game losing streak because the Knicks playoff started right around when that losing streak, I think, was going. So, you know, they're hiding. No one's really, I mean, there's coverage. You know, you got your Shermans, your Haymans, and the fans that usually complain, but it's not the front of the paper, and the usual suspects that do all of New York sports media are not out there getting their LOL Mets knives out. That's going to change now. Once the parade happens in a few days, you're going to have your stories over the next couple of days, and then the parade happens on Thursday. And by Friday, after they, you know, next weekend, people are going to put things aside, start looking towards taking a break from basketball. You'll get a little bit more of it when the Knicks start to report back in training camp in September. And then it's back to the grind, and it's in the history books. So enjoy the next week because you don't get these very often, right? So anyway, so Jason, look, I'm happy as you are. I don't think there's curses. I think the weight of uniforms could be akin to a curse. That's what I would say. That's how I'd comment on that. So I'm interested to hear what some of your guys' thoughts are on that. Sam writes, the Mets, this team just stays the same, fluctuating between 7 to 10 games under 500, and the offense is struggling most of the time. In my opinion, Vientos and Beatty aren't offering much as bats right now. On a positive note, Jared Young might actually be good while Bichette is finally hitting. It feels like it took too long. He took too long to get going. Funny is that he started to hit a little bit the last couple of days, and people are speculating. And Bob Nightingale reports it as you know, it's educated speculation. Reporters news that Bichette's going to opt out. So I found that interesting. It was also interesting to hear Stearns being asked if he regrets moving on from Hefner. Regarding McLain, he simply needs to be better. While he's young, there's no sugarcoating the fact that he has a very disappointing season relative to expectations, not just from fans, but from around the league. So far, he hasn't answered the bell. The thing about McLain is, and I say this all the time, you got to go around the league a couple of times. He only got 8 starts last year. The league has video on him. His ball moves. He's got 5 or 6 pitches. And if he doesn't stay ahead of hitters, he doesn't throw strikes to get ahead all that movement, then they just stand there and wait for him to throw strikes. That's why he's giving up the home runs. That's why he has to come in with some fat pitches. So I think this is about Justin Willard and the Mets figuring out how to hone his repertoire and how to get him to be more aggressive within the zone without throwing meatballs here to get ahead of the count. Because if he doesn't get ahead of the count, he's not gonna. He's gonna have these same struggles. I say this all the time. If you look at some of the great pitchers, Maddox, Glavin, Smoltz, you know, throw other names for the '90s, Randy Johnson, Kevin Brown. You know, even to a lesser degree, early in his career, Pedro. They're not perfect from the first jump. They go through ups and downs. They go through development. I mean, it took John Smoltz and Glavin. Took them like 3 or 4 years before they became who they are. And if you remember the story, Smoltz was struggling in 91, that first Braves division, where I think he was like 2-11 at the All-Star break, and they were thinking of putting him in the bullpen, but they stuck with him. And there he is getting, you know, starts in the postseason for a team that nearly won a championship. So I think that you have to see where McClain is going and how he develops, and not the overall numbers, and not compare him to Schlittler or be disappointed that he's not Harvey or DeGrom or Syndergaard, because I think that's the problem now. Every pitcher with promise has to be DeGrom. Every pitcher with promise has to be Harvey 2012. Every pitcher with promise has to jump on the scene like Syndergaard did in 2015 and 2016. And look, if you look at, and I've said this before, Zach Wheeler took a while. Zach Wheeler took 5 years. And he had to go to Philadelphia to really take it to the next level. I mean, he was starting to figure it out post-Tommy John when the Mets let him walk. So, Sam, I understand that. And then Sam wrote before the Knicks game yesterday, as for the Knicks being up 3-1, it's been a bumpy ride. They could easily be down 1-3, but luckily they aren't. I really hope they end the drought tonight because I can't bear the thought of blowing a 3-1 lead, especially to an arrogant and unlikable opponent like Wemby. So the point about that, this was written before last night's game when Sam brought this. Wemby is unlikable. Wemby's a great player. Wemby's young. He's 22 years old. I think it was amazing how the refs protected him in game five. I mean, he should have got a flagrant foul with the way he put his foot under Brunson. It seemed like there were times the Knicks would... They were playing him physical, and I think that's the thing the fans have to understand. You're not watching every slow-mo replay. You're just seeing certain ones where it looks like he just got touched. He's getting played so physical that I think he's hard to referee, but the protection is what I didn't like. You know, if you're going to play a physical game and let everybody play physical, then Wemby's got to handle the physicality as well. So, not a likable guy. Didn't like how he handled his way out the door yesterday, not shaking hands. You know, kind of being snippy with the media, who has been very good to him, by the way. I don't like how the fans threw eggs at him. I will tell you, in the history of New York sports villains, I think he's going to go up there with Reggie Miller, with, you know, Halliburton, how he did his thing last year. I think Wemby is going to be a bit of a MSG New York villain, maybe for the rest of his career. So it'll be interesting. So Sam, you know, now you don't have to worry about it. You just got to worry about the Mets, the Knicks, you know, you don't have to bear the thought of blowing the lead. And as Jason said, there's no such thing as curses over here. So we'll do that. Now I also have here something interesting. John Vanderwall wrote this and it made me want to do a little back of the paper bag, top line research. That's all I'm doing. Just some food for thought. And I thought this was really interesting. So one of the things that has come to my mind this year watching the sport is you had these outstanding pitching performances. And in particular, Christopher Sanchez, like 50-something innings without giving up a run. I thought he was going to break Hershiser's streak. Jacob Mizorowski the other night, one hitter. He's throwing 105 miles an hour. I mean, how long before he breaks? Giving up like... But, you know, he's like a 0.16 ERA in his last 8 starts. I mean, you're seeing two pitchers here already with like streaks of like what Orel Hershiser did in 88, what Don Drysdale did back in the day. And then you have Cam Schlittler and what he's done for the Yankees. I mean, they stand out. I said, you know, with this clean strike zone, because the strike zone to me is the cleanest it's been in my lifetime watching baseball. I don't know, you know, for those of you who have watched more baseball than me, And maybe, you know, I go, I mean, the 90s, I mean, I've said this. I think I said this on the last show in one of my shorts. Go watch. I always say this. Go watch clips, and I'll give you the one clip that'll blow your mind. Game 161, 1999, Rick Reed against the Pirates, a Saturday night. I was in the building that night. Just search. It's on X or search somewhere on YouTube. And you might even have just a compilation of Reed's strikeouts. But watch the game. Watch, I think he had 12 strikeouts that night. Watch how many of the strike three calls on the outside or inside corner where they are. I mean, it's like, it's amazing the east to west strike zone that was in the league back then. Amazing. I mean, these are not strikes by any definition of the book. I don't remember us complaining back then. So I say we have this clean strike zone. Are there certain, is it going to be harder for hitters to hit now? Because you're getting the call at the top of the strike zone now. That is not, when velocity is not easy to hit. So anyway, Vanderwall, and this is just me talking, it has nothing to do with Vanderwall's comment. Now, John Vanderwall, former big leaguer, known for being a pretty solid pinch hitter, lefty bat, Colorado, I think San Diego, more of a bench player, but a solid bat back in the 90s. And here's what he wrote the other day on X. Want to know how bad hitting has become? Go compare today's batting averages to those 20 to 30 years ago. Hitters back then had to cover a much bigger strike zone, especially on the outer half, where umpires routinely gave pitchers strikes off the plate. He's 100% right there. Today's hitters have a tighter zone, technology replay, and more information than ever. Yet, the offensive product is worse. And before the velocity and spin rate crowd jumps in, remember, TrackMan changed how velocity is measured. MLB's own documentation acknowledges that TrackMan measures the ball out of the hand and can read 2 to 6 miles an hour higher than older radar systems. The bigger problem is that over the last decade, baseball tried to reinvent the swing. The result? More strikeouts, less adjustability, less ability to use the whole field, fewer complete hitters. Pitching development isn't much better. It's become max effort, max velocity, and max spin rate. The game didn't get smarter. In a lot of ways, it got worse. So, okay. Let's just do some back of the paper bag math. And you don't want to throw 2026 because we're only halfway, you know, through. Let's just start with 2025. So, you know, I looked at 2025 last year, just the whole league, National League, American League. There was, you know, league hit 245, had a 719 OPS, 5,600 home runs, and there were 21,614 runs scored. So I was like, okay, hitting, let's just go. Let's just take some random points. Now, Vanderwall played in 2000. Now, 2000, height of the steroid era. Home run-wise, there was, 5,650 home runs. In 2000, there was 5,693 home runs. I mean, it's not that much different, right? Batting average was 270. Okay, it was 35 points higher. It was 245 last year. 782 OPS, 345 on-base percentage. Those are better numbers, the on-base and the batting average, than what we see today. So what we see is a home run sport with, you know, compared to 2000 with less people on base. But recovering, steroid era, a lot of bad bullpens, smaller ballparks. I mean, some relievers than some of these teams are so bad. You know, just go to, like, I'm not even talking about average, you know, bad teams. I'm talking about, go and look at some of the ERAs of, you know, got guys coming out of the bullpen with 6.5 ERAs during the steroid era. It's crazy. And we really didn't think about it back then because it was like, all right, whatever, you know, like everybody had good bullpen arms and bad bullpen arms and things like that. So, all right, you don't want to do 2000. I'm just going to pick, you know, seasons that are randomly part of the Mets. I think I've done this before, but maybe not. It just came to my mind. So now 1986. Much less on the home runs, 3,813, 258 batting average, a little bit higher than today, 326 on base, a little bit higher today, 721 OPS. So you compare it, it's actually a skosh in 86 better than today. And the big difference is less home runs. So there's more, you know, you could argue runs per game, 4.41 in 86, runs per game in 2025, 4.45. Negligible in my sense. So what we see today in terms of runs a game and scores, same as what we saw in 1986, relatively, when the Mets won the World Series last. Okay? You want to be more of a traditionalist? Let's go to 1969. They raised the mound and everything like that. Now there, You've got a 248. Now, 1969, 1986, a 258. 1969, a 248. No, I never hear anybody talk about how 60s baseball is bad, or the hitters in 1969 were bad compared to, you know, another era. Nobody ever criticizes the product. And I'm not even going to the Gibson year when the hitting was... I'll go further back after this. 248, 689 OPS, so below 600, below 700 OPS, 31-19 home runs. I mean, worse offense than today. And I'll do one better before we, you know, let's just go, I mean, 1962, you want to do first expansion? 61, pre-expansion. Let's just do 61. Lot less teams. 258 batting average, 328 on-base percentage, 727 OPS, slugging under 400, 399, and 2,730 home runs. By the way, that's the year where the Yankees hit 240 home runs because of Maris and Mantle. You know. So I guess here's the thing. We feel the game is worse. And look, the strikeouts, 40,000 plus strikeouts last year. In 1986, there was 24,706 strikeouts. So and that part of it, ninth, you know, strikeouts were high. They were in the 30s, 31, 356 in 2000. I get that. And if you go to 1961, it was far less. People didn't strike out at the rate. It was actually 14,000 strikeouts. But you got to remember a lot less teams. So it's not really comparable. You know, for example, the Yankees struck out 785 times. This last year, the Yankees are, the 61 Yankees in that league. I mean, the best contact team was the Royals with a little over 1,000 strikeouts. League average is, you know, 1,300 strikeouts here. You know, you look at 1961, league average is, you know, 830 strikeouts. So I think the thing is this. If the one criticism Vanderwall has about the sport is the strikeout, that's what I think is causing the agita about the game, because you have all these missed bats. And I don't think he could change it. Unless you want to start to say, hey, you got to lower the mound a little bit. I think the sport is going to be like that, because these guys with the spin, forget the velocity, the spin. Now, there was spin in every other era, but I don't think people are doing what they do with the ball now like they did back then. And I think everybody's throwing hard. And without, and Vanderwall can't deny this, without the, not only the steroids, the greenies that in the coffee that could get you going, it's going to be hard for guys physically to be peak day in and day out with the kind of schedule you have. I mean, for crying out loud, the Mets have been in on the West Coast, all their West Coast trips between the end of March until now. That's where I think Manfred might be onto something with realignment and getting maybe more within time zone games, being more regional. You know, even without, if they don't want to do a salary cap, more regional, those are the powerhouse teams, the Philadelphias, the New Yorks, the Bostons. You put them in the same division, you're having them fight out with each other. From a standpoint of market, not all those guys are going to make the postseason. Even if they all good, they're going to beat up on each other. It's almost like Series A and Series, you know, B in soccer, so a certain degree. And it's just being done through regionality because of the markets. So I thought that was interesting. I wanted to end the show on that point and give you some food for thought, because it looks like Vanderwall's point is really about strikeouts. I just gave you back of the paper bag math on top line stats, the whole league. There's not much difference. And as you get further and further away from the 80s, I mean, you go to 86, I mean, the strikeouts were in half. Now, is that because of the pitchers or the hitters? Is that because of hitting philosophy, where making contact and just dinking and dunking is not really something that is taught anymore, because you're taught to hit the ball hard? we talked a little bit about this with Ewing and Benj and how they go the other way. And I know that, you know, when you see how hitters don't hit with velocity, if they don't have the exit velo, they get criticized. So, you know, maybe that's part of accepting spraying the ball more. But, like, if you don't have those hitters, you know, A.J. Ewing is special with the way he does things. Mark Vientos can't play that way. At least if he had to change, it would be a big change. So, anyway, some food for thought here on this Sunday. And you know what? I hope you enjoyed the show. It's been a wild Knicks playoff run. I know that at times I've been interjecting it within the show and, you know, maybe a little bit more coffee for some of the premium content. It's been a tough couple of weeks for the premium content because I think that you've hit that point of the season where you're trying to not just throw content out for the sake of it, but you want some good stuff. But I'm working on some good pieces, looking at some of these bullpen pieces this week to see what's going on with them. We're going to start looking at pieces throughout the league that maybe could help the Mets if they could get back into this thing. And we'll continue to do our thing, continue to send me notes. You know, if you haven't sent me a note in a while, send me a note, and away we go. So anyway, want to thank everybody for tuning in to this latest edition of the Talking Mets podcast. You can check me out all the time at thetalkingmetspodcast.com. You get me on X at Talking Mets, no G, and on your favorite podcasting service, Apple, Spotify, pretty much whatever podcasting service you desire. If you want to interact with me, Mike Silva at talkingmetspodcast.com, no G, Mike Silva at talkingmetspodcast.com. Come join me at thetalkingmetspodcast.com. Chat for free, premium content, updates on the show, all at thetalkingmetspodcast.com. And I want to thank our friends from the Believe Network for supporting this show. I'm your host, Mike Silva. Enjoy the rest of your Sunday. We'll be back with another Talking Mets podcast next week. Till then, take care, everybody. Meet the Mets. Head for the party.